Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Our guest today is Ernest Owens, author of The Case for Cancel Culture, How This Democratic Tool Works to Liberate Us All. It was published by St. Martin's. It was just released. Ernest is an award-winning journalist, the editor-at-large for Philadelphia Magazine, president of the Philadelphia Association for Black Journalists. He hosts the podcast Earnestly Speaking. As an openly Black gay journalist, he's made headlines for speaking frankly about intersexual issues in society regarding race, LGBTQ, and pop culture. So, I'm an old white Jewish man with a cold, unmarried, and I don't wear a tie. You're a young Black queer journalist, married, with a bow tie. And should either of us cancel each other because of those things?
Well, absolutely not. In my book, cancel culture is not a matter of just personal taste and dislike. It is rooted in basically individuals that seek to cancel a person, place, or thing that they believe is doing something that is detrimental to their way of life. So we can coexist as who we are. It becomes cancel culture the moment someone is doing something that one views to be detrimental to their way of life. And this is not something as simple as a matter of preference or taste. So if you like, you know, coffee and I like tea, you're not canceled because I disagree with you over a matter of taste, right? But if you held certain beliefs that were more graver than that, more serious than that, that could cause, you know, detriment to my way of life, then I think that's when cancel culture enters the conversation. So for example, if you were someone that was pushing a policy that would lead to for me not to be able to have my marriage as a gay person, right? You supported businesses or was pushing an agenda that was seeking to repeal same-sex marriage, then my decision to, you know, boycott or call for cancellation would be warranted. You might say, hey, my beliefs, you know, to have books that are promoting critical race theory, you might say, hey, those books, you know, are divisive and you don't agree with them. You might seek to boycott the books that I'm promoting. That's a cancel culture. And in my book, I don't necessarily focus on determining what's bad or good, because good and bad is subjective. But more so, I defend the act, the ability for people to have dissent to cancel. And I talk about it in a various level of examples and, you know, case studies. But essentially, my book is arguing that both you and I, even if we may not agree on what should be canceled or not, we should be able to. And the truth of the matter is, everyone's canceling anyway. This book does not look at cancel culture as a new phenomenon. It's something that's been with us since the beginning of time. That's what I argue.
You know, it's interesting you said coffee and tea, because the analogy you make in the book and in your interviews with the Boston Tea Party is a great one for my readers at my bookstore and for the listeners of this, to put this in more concrete terms. Because like you say, it's not about the tea.
Right. It's not about the tea. You know, it's about why. Why did they dump the tea? The why is important, because to me, the why defines what gets canceled and what isn't. So if they said they dumped the tea down Boston Harbor because they thought the tea was disgusting, that's not cancel culture, right? You know, at the end of the day, maybe a new batch of tea could come and they'll be like, okay, we like this batch of tea better. So, you know, all is well. You go to a restaurant and you have a steak that's not good and you tell your friends, hey, this restaurant, their steak isn't good. You know, maybe that day you didn't like the steak, but maybe they'll revamp the menu and you'll go back again and the steak is better. But that's not cancel culture, because these are situations that are frivolous. These are situations that are easily correctable. But let's say for the you know, those who dump that tea, they say, you know, actually, we're dumping this tea to boycott the British tyranny that we've experienced, the taxation route representation. We're upset and we're going to let our stances be known that we're not going to keep getting taxed without a fair say. That's cancel culture. And well, that decision to do that, you know, is something bigger than just a matter of personal distaste.
Well, you know, you mentioned steak and moving to a different food from a different animal. You boycott Chick-fil-A. Everyone loves Chick-fil-A and you always want to go on Sunday when it's closed. But you boycott Chick-fil-A. It's not because it's not good, but what? Okay, let's take it from this side.
Yeah.
What effect is your canceling doing? Does it simply reflect your own views, or are you attempting to and somehow create an agenda that's going to foster others' cancellation of that restaurant until that restaurant hurts financially because of the cancellation?
I think the answer is both. I think, you know, both. One could be more effective than the other depending on what it is. You know, we've seen this throughout history where financial divestment has led to change. You know, when you think about some of the boycotts in the 1950s and 60s, you look at the countercultural movement, some of the LGBTQ protests against, you know, Kohl's beer. You know, there's always been some level of economic divestment that has taken place across the country when it comes to cancel culture. My decision not to support Chick-fil-A is simple. You know, they are actively supporting organizations and groups that are seeking to end gay marriage as we know it. And that impacts me directly as a openly gay married American. And, you know, I think that the Supreme Court made their decision in 2015, and I think that decision should stand. And people that are seeking to end it, I think, do not recognize that this will lead to discrimination and further problems for couples and Americans that seek to have rights. And, you know, what do I look like going to an institution where I'm putting my money, funding my own personal money that I've worked hard and earned, my gay earned money, to support an institution like that, that's literally trying to degrade my way of life? So my decision not to go is for that reason, but also the messages for my friends and for others that if you do not support institutions that are seeking to take back my rights, you shouldn't go to this place. Because if you go there, your money that is something that is going against the love of your cousins, your brothers, your friends, your family, your money is supporting the ability for this institution to continue to fuel lobbyists and others in Congress to take back my rights. So as a collective, we do take a stand against that. And I don't just say Chick-fil-A. I think about Kanye West. You know, he's very anti-Semitic. He has a lot of problematic views. I think to promote, you know, and defend Kanye West at this date and age, what does that look like to my Jewish friends? What does that look like to Black women in my life who have been offended by his misogynistic remarks over the past several years? I think that, you know, we talk as a society about how to make change. We can't make that change if we're complicit within these oppressive systems or problematic institutions that seek to harm us.
But going to extremes, take Harvey Weinstein, Kevin Spacey, R. Kelly, Kanye.
Mm-hmm.
Should we, okay, R. Kelly makes good music. Kanye makes good music. Harvey Weinstein made some of the best movies in the world. Kevin Spacey is a great actor. So, are you saying that we should never watch a movie like whatever, Forrest Gump, whatever movies Weinstein made? Should you not listen to Kanye's music anymore? And what effect would that actually have? Because it's really not going to hurt anybody monetarily in that situation.
Well, I think that individually, we all have to weigh in on it. I think there's a sense of retroactive counseling versus active counseling. This is a conversation that's being had about Dilbert right now. The Dilbert cartoons, you know, Adam Scott. And the
I always hated Dilbert, though.
I personally mean it, it doesn't have an impact on us, right? But I think for some people, you know, I did an interview with someone at Time last week, and they were asking, well, should people feel bad about liking it back in the day? I'm like, no, you can't retroactively, you know, penalize yourself for something you didn't know, right? I think that for people who, you know, go back and watch these movies, I'm at the end of the day, having the context that you have, understanding why. So for example, there are Disney films that have been labeled racist today. And then Disney Plus has labeled some of their older movies like Dumbo and Peter Pan. They've labeled by saying, hey, some of this stuff is culturally insensitive and offensive. And I still watch some of those movies, one, because I, you know, it's history. It's a way of understanding the past. And so for that context alone, it deserves to be around. But what's important, what I respect from Disney is that they acknowledge these problems, they let people know they have choice. So I feel as though if you're deciding to go back and watch some of these Harvey Weinstein films, recognizing that, okay, two things can be true at the same time. I'm watching this movie, you know, I appreciate it for what it is, but I'm also recognizing that the person who created this film, or, you know, in many ways produced this film, has problematic errors and issues. I think when it comes to musicians, because I think there's a reach here, right? You know, Harvey Weinstein wasn't starring in these films. He produced them. There's a lot of producers on films. I think to go in piece by piece might be a little bit more, you know, tedious. But I think there's something to be said for direct music artists like R. Kelly. Like R. Kelly's music and how he made it definitely was used in many ways as innuendo. Like I can't listen to an entire album by Aaliyah, the late, great Aaliyah, who he married when she was underage, where there was an album called Age Ain't Nothing But a Number. And in retrospect, knowing the history, that this album was about the two of them having an inappropriate statutory rape relationship, that she was basically writing an album with songs fawning over an older man that had no business dating her, and that he was producing this album by basically having, you know, inappropriate sexual relations with this young woman. The album is filled with songs about their relationship, even though at that time it could be implied, but now we know it's a fact. And so it's hard to listen to an album like that, recognizing that pretty much the songs were rooted in something that was more devious than what we initially thought. And so I can't listen to that album knowing that the artist in question who created it, who's now in jail for raping and abusing young women, that this album that he did many years ago was also contextualized in that way. It's just no way you can watch that and not separate the art from the artist, because in this situation, the artist's art is also tainted by this bad behavior.
Well, let's approach it from a different angle then. My daughter goes to the University of Richmond, and I'm driving down the main avenue, and they take him down all the statues of the Confederate generals and the last one, Robert E. Lee. And I'm thinking, I have two minds here. There was another one where there was stocks in this town square, and they removed the stocks, but because mostly Black people were put in those stocks and kept there. And I'm thinking, this isn't that smart, because those who don't remember history are doomed to repeat it. And that's, I think, right, the idea of having these things there for whatever having them there reminds you, again, and you're always talking about context, having them there actually allows us to remember. Once you take them away, the next generation is not going to know the harm that was done by these people. And that creates a conundrum in my mind.
Well, I think that what we have to be clear about is it history or is it celebration? My disputes with these Confederate statues is that we don't put a lot of people who are in the South that are in positions of power are not putting it there to remind people of the history of these people. They're using it to celebrate those people and to embrace them. And so if you are seeking to do education, then there needs to be acknowledgement of the wrongdoing to associate people with it. So for example, Disney films that I mentioned earlier, you know, they are replaying some of those Disney movies from the 1950s and before. Then they label it with a disclaimer to acknowledge the problematic behavior. So for example, Peter Pan, which is a very great Disney animated film. However, there is a scene in which they are mocking indigenous people, and it's highly offensive. And, you know, in context, they acknowledge that there is some problematic content. But knowing that and putting that disclaimer allows people to be able to watch this with the lens of recognizing that, you know what, hey, there are some things in this film that is not model behavior. There are things in this film that I should watch in a historical context, that in the 1950s, there was a different viewpoint about how Hollywood depicted indigenous people. We need to, in 2023, acknowledge that was wrong, but provide the education so people can see what not to do, right? So that history will not repeat itself. If these Confederate statues had that type of disclaimer and said, listen, this was a racist figure in our history that did a lot of harm, and put that in context, then I think it's appropriate to then say, you know what? We now are in a place where we can recognize that not only does people now live here freely, but before then, there were certain leaders that infringed upon the rights of some of our dear Americans, and in particular, Black people. that needs to be somewhat disclaimed. If you want to create context, you have to re-educate. And I'm not seeing these Confederate statues do that. I think that they're oftentimes used by legislators to actually celebrate these people like they're fallen heroes. And I don't think that these are heroes. I don't think that we should look at them as heroes. We should look at them as individuals that try to actively suppress the rights of people like myself and my ancestors. And if you think that that is something to celebrate, which I don't think you do, but those who put those statues there, shame on them. Because when you think about Germany, right, when they, you don't see them putting a bunch of statues of Hitler all over Germany to get the point across that he's a bad man. There's other ways that Germany has been able to articulate how the Holocaust and those poor leaders did. If you put this in a different conversation and context, it will sound ludicrous that in America, there are people that think it's okay to put up statues of Confederate leaders. You don't see that in Germany, of them just putting up statues of Nazi individuals that were leaders of the Holocaust. You don't see them putting up those statues. And even if they did, you wouldn't even imagine them thinking it would be okay to just put it there and tell people, well, we're going to erase history. I think people know who those people are. History, if taught correctly, would educate us on the narratives. And you have to think to yourself, is it aesthetically pleasing to put more statues of Confederate soldiers and leaders, more so than Black leaders? There are states that have more statues of Confederate soldiers than they do of actually Black heroes and folks that fought against for the good. Where are the Frederick Douglass statues? Where are the Sojourner Truth statues? Where are the heroes on the right side of history statues? There's more conversations about Confederate flags and Confederate soldiers, but I would challenge to say, why are they not pushing to acknowledge the good people who was in that fight? That's bias to me.
Okay, here's another one. There's so many ways you can come at your book because there's trigger warnings everywhere for everybody. Right. So you take, for example, the possibility of a backlash. I mean, look at DeSantis, who's running under the campaign Make America Florida. Just this week, and you've been following it, I've been following it, the College Board has kind of capitulated to him. Disney World is kind of because of Reedy Creek and the district. And he's canceled the advanced studies with regard to African Americans. He's now moved Don't Say Gay, if that's what you want to call it, up to eighth grade. He's prohibiting the pronoun usage. The problem is, as I see it, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way at all, but the more you push your agenda, the harder he's going to push against it. And the problem is, unfortunately, right now, he has more power than you. And the question is, just like with Trump, if he does this in Florida and Florida embraces it, then what do you guys do? What do we do?
Well, we have to go back to history. And I think we have to go back to remembering that this is a democracy. And in a democracy, we fight with our votes. We fight with our protests. We fight with our ability to have free speech. We mobilize, we organize. The same could be said right now in this time of history, back in the 1950s, Jim Crow laws that basically there were no, I think about my grandparents and my great grandparents, they were up against a different battle. They did not have social media. They did not have the same access to the free press. They didn't even have the right to protest without getting dogs sicked on them. They did not have that many allies collectively that supported them. There were members of the Jewish community, of course, in solidarity back then with the Black community to fight against racial discrimination and anti-Semitism. But we did not have the type of resources we have today, nor did we have representation in politics that was strong enough to take a stand. So if we lean into history, right, how did that group of people who had the least amount of rights, they didn't have civil rights, right? They weren't even acknowledged by the government as complete citizens. They were able to mobilize and organize in a way that was able to defeat these types of very spiteful policies and at the end of the day, change federal law. The same can happen here. We've seen it happen. People thought that it would be impossible for Trump not to see a second term. But you know what happened? People got up, people voted, people organized, people provided information to the public, and people really resisted. And Trump got out of office. And I believe that right now we're seeing the dog whistles and the warning signs of Ron DeSantis' behavior. And if enough Americans wake up educate themselves, show up to these town halls, put power to their votes, and also actively boycott and resist the behavior of Ron DeSantis, I think that these things that we're seeing right now will dissolve quickly. But it's going to require people to not give up. It's going to require people to fight even harder. In a democracy, you are in a consistent battle between good and evil. You're in a consistent power struggle between those who have the power and those who don't. But in this country, we've seen the little guy win. We've seen the little guy win. We've seen it happen throughout history. You wouldn't get LGBTQ marriage equality had it not been for the support that has come from Changing Hearts and Minds, but also really being frank about divestment and also being frank about organizing. So I don't think that Ron DeSantis will win. He has the lead right now, but if more people step up and speak out and show up and show out, we could see something different in 2024. That's how power works in America.
Okay, well, let's take devil's advocate, which I've kind of been throughout this interview. So yes. Suppose, and I'm kind of fatalistic, you're optimistic. So suppose that DeSantis or Trump gets elected in 2024. You know, I love Joe Biden, but I don't see why we should be electing someone who's 82 years old. It should be someone your age. Oh. And or thereabouts, you could try.
I'm 31, so I'm not eligible to, but you know, I hear you.
But so the point is, suppose some jackass gets elected and suppose Congress flips, which could easily happen. And you got to, for the rest of your life, almost, you have a 6-3 divided Supreme Court. You got the president, you got Congress, you got the Supreme Court. And I agree with you. You will win in the long term. But I think that today's youth, given their device time, given what they spend their time doing, I don't know if they're ready to commit to a long-term change.
I think so. I think that people underestimate that we have been leading these movements in spite of the lack of electoral power that we're still up against. I mean, I'm in Philadelphia, and it just seems like people are still describing young people as people that are in their early 40s. Like, they don't even think of 30s. They don't even think of 20s. They still think we're babies. And that paternalism is triggering, because when you think about a lot of these elected officials, when they got elected, you know, you think of Biden, for example, he got elected to the Senate in his late 20s. You look at some of these other elected officials who've been Congress people when they started their careers, they got a lot of those jobs in their early 30s, mid 30s. The problem is 40, 30 years later, they're still in those positions and they're telling young people like me at 31, wait your turn. And I'm like, well, how long do I have to wait? So I'm 50? Like, there is a weird dynamic between a lot of the boomers and millennials. I mean, Gen Xers are like the forgotten generation in some ways. But when you're looking at this political fighting, there's an interesting power shift that they have not been ready to relinquish power. And that's an issue that is really big right now on the left. The right has, you know, kind of softened a little bit on that. But the left has really been very pragmatic and have held a lot of these political seats to themselves. So young people are interested in politics. They want to lead. But we have to look at the gatekeepers who have held us back from being able to showcase our interests. So what we've done instead has been to lead movements on the ground. You see a lot of the work that's happening around Black Lives Matter. You see a lot of the work that's happening on the ground to resist. You're seeing progressive movements where they're putting up some of their candidates. You have that wonderful guy in Florida, that young Democrat, last name is Frost, who's 26 years old. He's a Gen Zer that is in Congress. There is interest. He won by youth movement. You look at the March for Our Lives and gun control. That was young people that led that fight. And so I think the reality is that unfortunately, until we see older political spheres of power relinquish their power, respectfully step down, pass the torch, then unfortunately, young people's only ability to be involved in political action is going to be mostly through boycotts and protests and marches.
Look, Obama is younger than me. I'm 70. He's like 62, maybe. So mm-hmm. But you're criticizing him because of his boomer. But he's like your best ally. He's our best ally. I wish he was president. And yet,
I mean, I think that no person in power is above reproach. I think that in any democracy, people have the ability to write, to critique certain aspects. Like, I like Obama. I think he's great. But I also can acknowledge that when it comes to this particular issue on cancel culture, we respectfully disagree. And, you know, that is okay. I think we as a society claim that we want honesty, but I do think people have a hard time accepting dissent. And I think they have a hard time accepting dissent from young people. I think they have a hard time accepting dissent from women. And I also think they have a hard time accepting dissent from people of color. And a lot of that, I think, is because in society, this verbalized public dissent from people that look like me is a new thing compared to decades upon end. Like, I say this when I think about my grandmother, and she's now no longer here. But in the 1950s, I use her as an example. A woman, a Black woman like her, a working class woman like her, from the South, she grew up in Marianna, Arkansas. She would not be able to have any voice in the public atmosphere. There was no rights or protections that allowed you, not you per se, but, you know, white men at that time, to consider her opinions, to validate them in a public sphere. So she would not be able to give lectures at Harvard like I did last week at the Harvard bookstore. She wouldn't be able to get an op-ed published in a major publication like the Washington Post or the New York Times like I did. She wouldn't be able to go on public platforms and critique the system or the law and criticize or have disagreements out loud like I did. If she did any of those things or protested or did any of those things at that time, there could be some level of arrest, retribution, and that would be legal. Fast forward to 2023, because of her, because of others that spoke up and spoke out and pushed back against that type of totalitarianism from our government, someone like me, who's 31 years old, can be able to do all of those things. And I think that for some of those people who, from back in 1950 and 1960s, who lived to see that people like my voice was not allowed to be in the sphere, they're having a hard time wrestling that now not just only white men are given a platform, but people like me, they have to share it with. And that's difficult. That's a cultural shift. That's a cultural adjustment. Like, what does it look like to live in a world where you only have to consider the opinions publicly and nationally of those that look like you? Now you have to hear input from various age groups, various racial identities, various gender identities, various sexual orientations. And now your opinion is being challenged by a multitude of people. That's hard for some people to adapt to know that you can't just simply have an opinion as a white man in America, where you've always had an opinion and you could have an opinion in society without any challenge. But now you have an opinion that isn't only being heard by other white men like you, but now it's being heard by various communities and demographics of the country that once did not have that say. And so I think there are some people that are grappling with that reality, that now they have to hear my voice. They now have to hear other people's voices that may not agree with them. And that's hard for them. You know,
so if we go to particular cases, then did you see Chris Rock's live stream the other night?
Absolutely. And it was horrible.
Yes. And I saw him like 2 months ago and he was already talking about Suge Knight and actions speak louder than words and all that and sticks and stones. They say it's the first time. It's not the first time.
It's not the first time. No.
But then you talk about what Will Smith did versus what. I forgot who was the other person. It was Will Smith doing it. It wasn't Mel Gibson, but it was kind of like that thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, but the thing about Will Smith is, why can't you just look at it like he made a mistake? He's contrite. Because you don't think apologies are necessarily sincere now, which I don't think they're sincere at all. You know, our hopes and prayers, our thoughts and prayers are with you. You know,
agreed.
Yeah, So like, okay, so Will Smith, once again, Men in Black, shouldn't watch it anymore. Should he be ostracized forever, banned from the Oscars, all that stuff?
I honestly feel like, in my opinion, and in my book, I love that these are good questions. These are really great questions. My book tackles a lot of these points. So in my book, I do a chapter called Not All Cancellations Are the Same. And I argue in this section of the book that, you know, I will say that cancel culture is subjective, meaning that there could be someone that's canceled that you don't think should have been canceled. And you have every right to push back against that. I personally do not believe that the consequences that Will Smith faced from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences was warranted based on his incident. Should there have been a consequence? Sure. But I think the level of severity of the consequence he received, I personally feel like it was not warranted. And that was
It was done for the optics.
It was done for the optics. And I think that it was done in bad faith, right? I think that the rationale behind why they did it was done in optics, and I think it was done in bad faith. So I don't really consider that a legitimate, in my opinion, a legitimate cancellation. Some people might, but I personally don't think it is. And so we have to be mindful that in society, there are acts of cancel culture that are done by bad faith actors or done by individuals with malice, right? So for example, Ron DeSantis, okay? Ron DeSantis wants to cancel critical race theory. That's his choice. I don't agree with that. I'm going to continue to read different books from different people. I'm going to continue to study various forms of scholarly research information. Just because that's something he wants to cancel doesn't mean something I want to cancel. And so we have to be mindful that just because people seek cancellation doesn't mean that all of us have to agree with it or not, but we have to be willing to justify that in spaces where people might push back.
So I'll give you a perfect example. At my bookstore, every year when they do the banned books thing, I put every banned book in the window of my bookstore.
Okay.
But now Dr. Seuss, and now what about Huckleberry Finn? What about Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer? They're banned.
I mean, as long as my whole thing is this. That's why I say not all cancellations are the same. You know, I'll say this much. When we think about canceling of individuals. In my book, I articulate certain examples where some people had swifter punishments than others. And a lot of that is based on status, race, gender, you know, overall power. You know, I'll give an example. Chrisette Michele was an R&B singer who, you know, decided to perform at Trump's inauguration in 2017. She faced a lot of criticism and scrutiny, and she was canceled by her fan base and by a lot of people. And her career has never recovered from that. But if you look on the other end, Kanye West, a big Trumper, a guy who also has been supporting Trump aggressively, his pathway to cancellation was given with thousands of excuses, and fans supported him. What's the difference between Chrisette Michele and Kanye West? Several things. One, Kanye's a man. Two, Kanye is a more known artist with a bigger fan base and platform. So when you're that famous and that powerful, it's harder to cancel you compared to a Chrisette Michele, who, you know, had moderate success, won a Grammy, but did not have the same fan base as Kanye West. So what we have to recognize is that there are people like, you know, I'll give another good example, somebody like a Don Imus, who went on radio and said nappy headed, you know, to black women. That man was canceled. And I believe he should have been. But you got a guy like Donald Trump that has consistently said insults to various communities. And in spite of that, he still is popular. He still was popular, got elected the president with all of these issues. And so there is a double standard because the issue is that cancel culture is being carried out by people like us and humans are imperfect. Humans got biases. And all of these institutions, the criminal justice system, the police, the law, the healthcare system, all of these institutions are flawed. And they're flawed because humans are flawed individuals. And so in some ways, we do seek to do the right thing, but in some cases, we drop the ball or we do things improper. And so I look at cancel culture as a tool. Because to me, a tool can be utilized or it can be weaponized. I look at cancel culture like a knife. You know, it could be an asset to help you conveniently eat your steak, which I love, or it could be weaponized as a weapon to cause harm to people. So who holds that tool will determine its outcome. If a very virtuous, mature adult uses the tool of cancel culture to fight for equal rights and justice, good Godspeed. But if a bigot is seeking to cancel and use it for devious ways, then misfortune is upon us. So the power is, how do we empower the good people in our society? How do we embolden them with this tool to cancel? Because when they do, they've done incredible things.
Well, you know what? Let's take one that's really controversial, because I think Dave Chappelle is a genius. He's one of the funniest people I've ever heard. And then he does that special, which Netflix, you know, let go on. And he says horrible things about the trans community that weren't funny. If they're funny, I give props if it's really funny. If it's not funny, but then when he went on Saturday Night Live, and that was right after Kanye did his thing, and he goes, you know what? You know, Kanye, you got to apologize. That'll buy you a little time. And then he goes, you know what? I've been out here. There are a lot of Jews in Hollywood. So it's like this backhanded support of Kanye. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, you can't blame me for having two different minds about these things. It's just natural.
No, well, of course.
You know, when the Dave Chappelle show was on and I watched it, I was saying, this is so fucking funny.
Well, and yeah. Of course. And I appreciate that, your thoughts. The thing is that, you know, people, this is not easy, right? You know, I grew up watching Bill Cosby. The Cosby Show was a staple in my house. You know, I thought Bill Cosby was the ideal type of, you know, TV dad, and was like, oh, he's such a great guy. And, you know, and it took me a while. I mean, you know, once the allegations and the stories came out, I took a step back and I was like, you know, who do I like here? Cliff Huxtable is a character. And that's who I admired, was the character. I never knew the real Bill Cosby. I don't know who the real Bill Cosby is. But there has been several things Bill Cosby has said and done, even outside of this situation, this pound cake speech he did many years ago, just certain things about Bill Cosby that I've heard over the years that I realized I don't like Bill Cosby. I liked Cliff Huxtable, but I did not like Bill Cosby. And so I was able to separate those things. And I think in society, we sometimes live in these imaginary binaries where one thing is here and one thing is here. Two things can be true at the same time, but you have to make a decision. And so where I came at it was, is that, you know what? Cliff Huxtable was a great American TV dad, but he was played by a monster. And I have to live with the reality that this man, this TV show was impactful in the culture. And it was, there's no denying that. However, the man behind it was horrible. I think about, you know, Ronald Dahl, who wrote those great books, Matilda and Charlie and Chocolate Factory. This man was anti-Semite. Yep. And I'm just like, well, these were good books, but I'm not going to not forget that this man also holds these problematic beliefs. I think with Dave Chappelle is that we have to recognize that celebrities like Dave Chappelle, comedians like him, people evolve. I mean, look at Roseanne Barr. Look what she became. You know, I grew up watching Roseanne when I was little. Like, Roseanne was like, you know, a lot of those great TV shows back then. And it's like, wow, this is who she is. This is what she says. This is what she believes. You know, you just, you know, once you know, you know. And we see a lot of our heroes become villains before our very eyes. And so, you know, with Dave Chappelle, I grew up watching Dave Chappelle. Not so much. I shouldn't have been watching. I was super young. And some of the jokes he made back then did not age well. But, you know, he was a different, interesting figure. But I think he's been on decline. I think that a lot of what he does now isn't bold, isn't kind. I think that a lot of what he do now is rooted in this sense of controversy and relevance. And he's punching down in a way that has made him a cranky old bitter man that has lost his luster and now is basically cruising off of his past victories to keep him relevant today. Because if the jokes he's making right now were the types of jokes that he pushed and led on at the start of his career, he would not be the Dave Chappelle we know now. And I think that just shows us that sometimes People can get drunk off of Hollywood and power and become bad people. And listen, he might have been something better back then, but the Dave Chappelle then is not the Dave Chappelle now. And we cannot continue to hold onto nostalgia to somehow exonerate or defend the current bad behaviors of now.
Well, look, in your last interview, you talked about, you know, Louis C.K. selling out whatever, Madison Square Garden.
That's
and then
right.
Roseanne coming back and starting to do that again.
That's right.
And you know, I don't know what your response was. I know you're offended by it.
Yes.
But how do you, I mean, that's a difficult one too, because it's actually happening. Louis C.K. had a hangout doing nothing for 5 years. And now apparently he's forgiven and he's going to have a tour and all that.
Well, you know, listen, again, not all cancellations are the same. I think that, you know, I don't like him. I'm never going to support Louis C.K. again. But there was a consequence, right? He had to go away for 5 years. And he had to probably go away for 5 years to reflect. I think the real test is, will this man ever do the things he done again? I don't think so. I hope not. I think he's probably going to think twice before he decides to do some of the most inappropriate, disgusting things. He is never going to recover fully from this. It will be a stain in his legacy. There's no way you could talk about Louis C.K. and not talk about that history. At the end of the day, his fans, right? The democracy is that people decide how long you stay in cancel culture jail, quote unquote. Mocking something that Chrissy Teigen had said. But, you know, people decide, you know, the public decides, you know, sometimes there's people that are like, you know what, never again, right? So like R. Kelly, as of right now, never again for R. Kelly. For Louis C.K., you know, 5 years. For Roseanne Barr, 5 years, right? We put timestamps on it for certain people, sentences. And I think the problem is with powerful people is that they don't want to have any of those sentences. So they want to do away with it because they don't want any consequence. But accountability is what sticks in. And so people will ask me, well, Louis C.K.'s back. I'm like, well, first of all, let's get our words together. What does that mean that he's back? Is he back in the way he was before? I don't think so. I mean, there are certain famous people where, like Roseanne Barr, for example, she's never going to be on network TV the way she used to be. I mean, she's literally doing a comedy series on Fox Nation. This woman went from being primetime television gold with Emmy nominations to now being on some niche television station that's for a certain demographic of people. I feel like cancel culture has definitely impacted her career. I think Louis C.K.'s career has been impacted. It may not be the way that, I think some people think that cancel culture means permanent, complete abolition. No, it's a range. It's a range. Like I cancel my Netflix subscription. Does that mean that Netflix itself is canceled? No, it's just me deciding to unsubscribe. So I think as a society, we choose to opt in and opt out of when we want to deal with certain people. And that's our democratic right. But let's not act as though consequences have not been felt or held. To act as though Roseanne Barr, you know, Louis C.K. have not experienced any consequences for their behaviors is intellectually dishonest. I think some people want to create the avalanche slope that, oh, you do something bad, you're banished for life. The far right loves to say that as a way to scare people into holding them accountable. But in society, we know that most people are not being canceled in that type of manner. Some people are being told that, okay, you can't perform at this concert or you can't have this platform, but that doesn't mean you're totally ostracized in society. I don't think I know anyone in this country who is of power that's been completely, totally ostracized in a way that they're completely cut out. I mean, look at Donald Trump. The country may have said, you know what, we're not voting for you. And maybe he's been taken off of Twitter and Facebook, but this man created a whole new social media platform so he could do his rants. So how canceled or how badly impacted is Donald Trump? It ranges. And well, so I think that it's subjective.
Let's do one I consider the most polarizing one. And hear me out, because it's going to take a couple of minutes for me to set this up.
Okay.
And I'll start it without noble and good your book is, which you got to like that. And because you say, you know, cancel culture doesn't mean you can just insult somebody. It doesn't mean you can throw rocks because you don't like them. So the one for me that really triggers me is J.K. Rowling. I mean, she wrote these great books. Mm. She's getting thousands of death threats. She fights back as hard as she can. And all of the people whose careers she created now distance themselves from her. They decided they can't have the name Quidditch in the Quidditch Society anymore, and they have to change the name of it. It's all absurd to me. I mean, basically what she's saying is something that you may disagree with, is that sex is different than gender. If you're born with a penis, you're a guy. If you're not born with a penis, then you're a girl. And that's, I'm of two minds about that too. But the point is, I think she's a great writer. I honestly think she's a good person. And I think she's a strong person. But, and I don't know whether she's even canceled or not. All I know is that the people who are attacking her, threatening to kill her. And that goes to what you said initially about that's not what you want to do. So give me, okay, I'm done. You give me your opinion about that whole thing.
Well, I think we need to take some things into account, right? That in any situation around cancel culture, there are going to be people who are not actually canceling. There are going to be people that jump on with a sense of bad will, right? I mean, that's what happened with Black Lives Matter. There are, you know, reported incidents where there's been bad actors that were hired to go to Black Lives Matter protests and stir up the pot to try to dismiss and distract the public from engaging on this important issue.
Yeah, the whole Antifa thing.
Correct. So that's the same thing here. I think that the transgender activists and advocates and their allies who's been calling J.K. Rowling out for her problematic behavior, which, let's be very clear, she has consistently pushed narratives that has made her be viewed as a TERF, which is T-E-R-F, a trans exclusionary radical feminist.
Which is a badge that Dave Chappelle wears with honor.
Yes, of course, because Dave Chappelle is a bigot, in my opinion. The reality is that, you know, because of that, there are people who disagree and are offended and feel betrayed by her. And that is a fair critique, that this is a person who is one of the most successful authors of all time, with the highest selling books of all time. And some of her fan base, a large group of her fan base, are LGBTQIA youth. And the person that they thought that they were supporting is pushing messages that basically is seeking to erase their existence and identity. That's a very serious matter. And I think that, yes, there are some people that are doing death threats and whatnot. That's completely inappropriate. That's not cancel culture. And what we should not do and be careful of doing is paint that the large dissent is those people. I know that there are situations where I've had people on the far right that have criticized me, and there are some who have gone as far as threatening me and harassed me. But the majority of critique I've gotten from people that are conservatives are not doing that. So while there are a few bad actors, what I will not do is mischaracterize the large dissent as being more civil than that. So I believe that the people who are mostly critiquing J.K. Rowling are not doing death threats, are not doing the cyberbullying. There is a collective of those people who are, but those are not the same people that I am justifying and thinking have a right, right? I've been critical of J.K. Rowling myself. I think that it has been disappointing to see her consistently make these remarks and then at the same time try to play like she's just this innocent martyr. She's a woman with a huge global platform. What she says can influence policy and society. She has a huge platform. And what annoys me about celebrities and influencers and politicians is that they try so hard to dumb themselves down and act like they're everyday people, that they're just a person with an opinion. No, you have an opinion that gets world news. And when she makes these remarks, it gets worldwide coverage, which means that thousands upon millions of people can read every day when she thinks about these communities, and that forms judgments that can be wrong. I mean, think about Kanye West. He had a platform that spewed anti-Semitic views. And what happened? There was an uptick in hate crimes, specifically anti-Jewish sentiment that was connectly linked to Kanye West and The Rise when he went on those anti-Semitic raids. There are people that will put up signs that said Kanye West was right. So let's not act like she's just some person in a little house, sipping tea, having an opinion, and that woe is I that a bunch of people were offended and spoke out. If she gets to use her platform to spread misinformation about various gender communities, then those people who she offended have a right to speak up against what she did. And I think that the problem is in society is that we're so used to marginalized people being silenced and being excluded that now we live in a world where you can't say anything negative about Black people and expect them not to have an opinion back. You can't simply disrespect women, Muslims, minorities, immigrants, indigenous people, and not expect for those people to have a seat at the table. I think the J.K. Rowlings of the world grew up in a society where they saw marginalized people being disrespected, and everyone just said, that's my opinion, and they can get away with it. The problem is that now you can have your opinion, but so can I. And maybe in discourse and in debate, you learn something new that you didn't want, that you didn't learn before, because that's how society educates themselves. A person says something ignorant about a group of people. Said group of people says, you know what you said is wrong and here's why. Now you have a choice at that point. You can either learn something new and change your mind, or you can continue to stand firm on your belief. And then what happens then is that as you continue to push that same bigotry, you're being met by folks that have the right to push back. That is what civil dialogue and discourse looks like. It's so funny that people on the right are always saying free speech, but it seems like they only want free speech for people that agree with the things they agree on. That's not how free speech works.
Well, let's, like I said, the other reason I feel like this book is good, because we could sit here and talk for hours because I can approach it from all different kinds of angles.
Correct.
So is, and again, you got to hear me out on this one. It's the anatomical one. So you got, I'm outside of Philadelphia, you're in Philadelphia. You got this Penn swimmer who's okay as a guy, not great. He identifies as a woman. He's been through puberty, he has wider shoulders, he has a smaller pelvis. He then swims and he saws a penis and he swims and he will beat every woman in the world forever by a large margin. To me, that seems inherently unfair. On an anatomical basis, it's just not fair that he should swim with them, because these women who have trained as hard as they possibly can only hope to come in as a distant second now because of what he's done. So respond to that.
You know, honestly, I believe that, you know, she is playing a sport that is aligned with her identity. And, you know, I think that the people that be that have allowed her to have that right, that's her right. And I think that, you know, individuals who disagree with it, you know, they should, you know, consider the discourse and figure out how to navigate past it. But honestly, I don't think I'm in the business. I don't think it's my place to define that person's gender as anything than what they identified themselves as. So she is a woman. That's how she identifies. And I'm going to respect that. And she's playing in a woman's sport, which she is aligned with her gender, how she identifies. And other people clearly agree, because otherwise, if that wasn't the case, she wouldn't be on the team. True. And that's it. And to me, if people don't like it, they don't have to like it. That's their personal opinion. But I think we could all be respectful. We could all be civil in the fact that we don't have to misgender this individual. We don't have to, you know, go through the debate of what we think, you know, is a person or whatnot. I think, you know, the teams and people in place that has allowed her to play that sport clearly respect her and respect her identity in which manner to which thought that she was qualified to play. She is the end. You know, it's interesting because people are so fixated on gender in this case. But when we talk about the larger sweeps of injustice, talk about unfair advantages, we don't talk about that when it comes to college admissions and public, you know, public school access to education and who gets a head start based on zip codes and living. You know, it's very interesting what people choose to cherry pick about what's an injustice and unfair advantage when these types of injustices and disadvantages have been impacting sports in different ways for years, not about this individual and their gender identity, but like the nature of who gets to get recruited in certain sports teams, who gets the, you know, get the ACT, the SAT prep, the ACT prep, the resources to get to go to what good schools and bad schools. You know, there's a lot of inadequacies in society, especially in the college system and around sports. And it's interesting who chooses to pick which thing to call out when there's so many other things that can be caught up within this flawed sports system. So
yesterday yeah. I read that the French and the Canadian World Cup women's soccer team, World Cup's coming up, you know, some of them are going to boycott, some aren't, because they're not getting equal pay still not getting equal pay.
Correct.
So again, as an old white man, my opinion is like, wait a minute, why should they get equal pay? Because no one watches them. So the revenue that comes from the men's World Cup is enormous. The revenue that comes from the women's World Cup is minuscule. So in my mind, the equal pay makes no sense, because it would be like this incredible singer or author selling more. So he's going to get more money, or she's going to get more money, because she sells 1,000 times as many books as somebody else. Yeah, concept of equal pay for those two makes no sense to me. But again, I'm speaking from a perspective, so that's not your perspective.
I think that that's sexist. I think that the reason we have to unpack why that is, there is pay disparities, right? One is that we live in a sexist society that structurally, this is structurally sexist. They fund more money towards male programs and marketing to basically invest in supporting the success. These men are not necessarily better than women in any type of way. So when you see a situation where you can see two groups of hard playing athletes, why is there more energy towards men? Is because there was more money invested in supporting men's sports than women's sports. That was, they create the inequity that they're now trying to use against women who deserve a higher pay, because they're, you know, busting their butts out there on the field. They deserve to be represented and supported for their health and for other reasons. So I think that to say, well, oh, the men's teams make more money, it's because they also invest more money into them. If they invested the same amount of resources, marketing, and energy to women's sports like they do men's sports, I would argue that there would be a very different reality. And when we see resources, I mean, we think about tennis. I mean, Serena Williams, my God, is an example of what happens when you invest in women in sports. What happens when you say, you know what, we need to pay attention to women's tennis in a way that almost rivals that of men. That's what happens. You get superstars that we can all be proud of, that I think Serena can kick so many of those men's butts out there in the court. And part of that is because they invested, Nike and these other groups invested and, you know, paying attention to her sport. So I think other women in these other teams need to be given a chance to shine, and they need to be given a platform and with real investment to do so. And I think paying them, you know, a fair share is a way to then also hold the industry accountable to saying, okay, if you're paying them equal pay, then that means that we need to also give them equal marketing to make sure that we make up and recover those funds. So okay. Now the onus is on them to get better, to make those teams better so that they can now rise to the occasion. And I believe the women will. I think they will rise to the occasion because they often do in history.
We should, so as we conclude, we should go downtown together and have a debate. That would be fun. But because we could go back and forth. But the thing about it is that I love so much about both of us is that what we're having now is civil discourse,
correct,
which doesn't really exist in this country anymore. So correct. Here we are, having a pleasant conversation. We appear to like each other. I like you. I hope you like me.
Dang.
And we can have different points of view and discuss them intelligently. And that's what's so depressing for me, again, as a fatalist, is that I don't see that in many venues anymore, you know?
Well, you have to allow people to read books. You know, books are important. If you ban books, you ban the opportunity to have discourse. You also ban opportunity for people to learn. I was very intentional when writing this book. I knew that the book was going to ruffle feathers. And that was the intention. The intention was to write a book that no matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat, you're a leftist or a right, whatever you are, there is a place for you to have an opinion that you can't formulate. There are a lot of liberals that have come to me and said, I don't know how I should feel about your book. I'm like, good. Because this book was not written just for you. This book was not just written for the far right. This book was written for all of us because it's such a nuanced book. And we're missing a lot of diverse thought leader books, books that are trying to shift the conversation. A lot of books that are out now, it makes me feel like Fox News and MSNBC. They're like, you know the target audience, you know the position, and if you like the person, you read the book. If you don't, you don't. But this book is a book that is forcing people on both sides to have to wrestle with their inconsistencies and their victories, right? Like in this book, I talk about when conservatives cancel, when progressives cancel. I talk about good things, I talk about bad things. But this is a book for everyone to read and learn. And I've been going on various platforms. I went on Piers Morgan Uncensored. I went on an interview on Newsmax. I've been going on different platforms to talk about this book because every person in this country, I believe, that are interested in understanding the cultural wars and interested in understanding cancel culture should read this book.
I agree. That's a good way to stop. And I want to thank you so much for talking to me today. I really enjoyed our conversation. I think it's valuable. And I always think it's good when someone writes a book that after you put the book down and close the covers, you're still thinking about it. And that's what your book is.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you.